Hi, I'm Kelsey.
And I'm Sarah.
And you're listening to Sisters of the Blue,
an ocean-minded science show on KCSB 91.9 FM. Today we're talking with Umi Hoshijima.
I'm a fourth-year PhD student at UC Santa Barbara.
And today we will be hearing more about
his experiences and research diving in Antarctica.
The men are off on their first introduction to this new world of the frigid seas.
Did you know?
Organisms are affected by the chemistry of the water around them. This ties in really well with impacts of climate change specifically. So we all know that we've been increasing the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, specifically carbon dioxide, and that's made the Earth warmer because the Earth's been holding in a lot of its heat that would otherwise be radiated out. We've been concerned a lot with global warming in the context of global climate change, but what a lot of people didn't realize until fairly recently is that the oceans have been absorbing a lot of that carbon dioxide. So about a third of the carbon dioxide emissions that have been released by humans have actually been absorbed into the oceans. And while this may seem like a good thing because it's slowing down our global warming, the oceans are actually getting acidic as a result.
It's a mad, 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 mad world.
Carbon dioxide dissolves into seawater to form carbonic acid, and that makes it particularly difficult for things making shells out of calcium to be forming their skeletons, and it can actually even start to dissolve away their shells under certain circumstances. So because of this, we're very concerned about the warming in combination with things like ocean acidification and how they impact a lot of animals along the coastlines.
And now we're lucky enough to have Umi play his accordion for us live at the Marine Science Institute. And without further ado, here's Umi. And now we're back with Sisters of the Blue on 91.9 KCSB FM. During the course of your PhD, how many times have you been to Antarctica for your research?
So I've had the great fortune of going to Antarctica 2 times so far, and I'm about to go a third time. So that makes 27 weeks in total. So about half a year of my PhD has been spent down at McMurdo Station, Antarctica. And McMurdo Station is the biggest station in Antarctica. It's about 1,000 people maximum capacity, and it's where I spend a pretty good chunk of my time. I think the time I spend in Antarctica has shaped me professionally more than the whole rest of the time in my as a PhD student. And that's particularly because you're suddenly there, and Antarctica is a very special place to be as a scientist because everyone who goes to Antarctica is only there either as a scientist or to support science. So you're really the star of the show there when you go to Antarctica. You're the person that everyone is there to. Everyone's trying to make sure that your research happens, and it really can put you on the spot sometimes. And it's really incredible because you're allowed all these resources, and people are there to help you. But at the same time, it's your responsibility to be professional, and you're representing the privilege that you have as a researcher in the Antarctic. And so while things can go wrong, Antarctica, the weather can be very bad. It can be difficult to find things if you break them. Obviously, there's no Home Depot around the corner. You really have to improvise and also be professional and really work hard to get your work done, all while being sort of a representative of all the scientists down there. I think it helps you think on your feet, and it helps you not panic about situations and think rationally and sort of work productively at the same time. So all in all, I think that how I see myself as a scientist now has really greatly been shaped by Antarctica.
Cool. So what sort of things is the Hoffman Lab doing to better understand ocean acidification?
And for those of us who don't know what ocean acidification is, you can think of it as when carbon dioxide is absorbed by seawater, chemical reactions occur that reduce the seawater pH or make it more acidic. And this can make calcium carbonate dissolve, the stuff that's really biologically important for many calcifying species. And when this occurs, these chemical reactions are termed ocean acidification, or OA for short.
So we're very interested in how certain key organisms in different food chains can be impacted by a lot of different climate change factors. So specifically, we're interested in changing temperature and changing carbon dioxide concentrations in seawater and how they might impact key animals in food chains at very key vulnerable points in their life stages. So locally, one of our big study organisms has been the sea urchin. We expect the sea urchin might be vulnerable because it forms this calcium skeleton. And even as a tiny larvae, it starts to form tiny needles in its body that act as a small skeleton. Also, in this larvae stage, we expect they might be the most vulnerable. They're very small. They haven't had a time to really develop a lot of the physiological complexity that you might find in an adult. Paired with this data, we're also interested in how pH naturally varies around coastlines. What this tells us is what sort of pH ranges animals along our coastlines might be experiencing now, and that might help us pinpoint animals that are currently being exposed to wide ranges of pH. There's two ways this could go. They could either be already resilient to big changes in pH, so they might have adapted to very wild changing pHs, or they might be already at their limits, and both of those are very interesting to us. Now, finding places with different pH is also interesting because it might pinpoint places in the future that might be able to act as a refuge against ocean acidification in a local way.
And now we're going to take just a little break to listen to Beach House, and we'll get back to the show Sisters of the Blue in just a few minutes here on 91.9 KCSB FM.
Thank you.
And now we're back with Sisters of the Blue on 91.9 KCSB FM. When would be the best time to go do research in Antarctica?
Generally, Antarctica is in the southern hemisphere, so all the seasons are backwards. I usually go down in about late September to early October. And so that's about the same as April here in the northern hemisphere. And so that's somewhere in spring, so it's just getting warm enough for you to be able to go outside and do your research. We travel on the sea ice, so a lot of our traveling to our locations happens by driving over frozen ocean. What that means is that we can't be there late in the summer because the ocean that's frozen over starts to melt and crack, and it becomes unsafe to go there. And so we can only really stay there until about early to mid-December. So we get there when it's warm enough to work, and we leave when it gets too warm to stay there. And when we get there, the coldest I've seen, I think, is about minus 40 with wind chill, maybe about minus 50. And by the time we leave in December, it can be above 0 Fahrenheit pretty regularly. So over that span of time, it can actually change pretty dramatically. When we get there, it's about sort of a normal light dark. So we get about maybe 14 hours of daylight and then 10 hours of night. And then within about 2 or 3 weeks, the nights get shorter and shorter, the days get longer and longer. And by mid-October, you see your last sunset for the whole time you're there. So for the last 2 months or so that I've been there, it's been 24-hour sunlight, which is pretty incredible and a little weird to get used to.
And what does it look like under the ice?
And so I've been lucky enough to be able to dive under the sea ice near McMurdo Station in Antarctica. And this has mostly been to either collect animals on the bottom or to retrieve or deploy these ocean sensors that we have. And the diving is absolutely incredible. In order to get into the water, you have to get a big drill out and drill through 6 feet of solid ice. The holes that get drilled are about 4 feet in diameter, so big enough to slip through, but not super roomy. And what happens is they drill a big hole, and then they drag a heated hut over it, kind of like an ice fishing hole. And that means that you can get out of your dive, and you'll be in a nice toasty room. When you drop down into the hole, you first, you know, you're going down underwater, but you first have to go through about 6 feet of ice, right? So you're going down a tube, and then suddenly the whole expanse of the underwater breaks out in front of you. And the visibility there is some of the best you can get in the world. It's hundreds and hundreds of feet of just perfectly clear water. And that's because right when we get there is early spring, and that means that the water has been in darkness for months. And so there's very little phytoplankton in the water to green it up. And so the water is super clear for that time of year. When you're under the ice, it can be really bright or really dark, and that depends on how much snow ended up falling. So some dives in certain locations, if it's very snowy, it could be almost pitch black when you drop down, and that's because there's a bunch of snow above you blocking the light, and it's pretty much like diving at night. Even though the water is incredibly clear, it's pitch black. There's other locations where the winds are very strong and they sweep all the snow away, and the diving is just perfectly clear blue water, very sunny. And as time goes on, when we're there October through December, what happens is the sun is up more and more, and you start getting a little more algae in the water.
The coastal waters of the Antarctic Peninsula are rich in phytoplankton.
And you also start getting algae on the bottom of the ice. So when you look up when you're diving, sometime in about November or December, the ceiling starts to turn greener and greener. So it's sort of like diving under a big stained glass window. And everything starts to sort of tint green as the light streams down. And it's a really incredible seascape. One of the best things about diving in Antarctica is that up on the surface of Antarctica, you look out and it's ice everywhere. Where we are in Antarctica, it's a volcanic island, so the rocks are black. And it's a very black and white landscape. It's very beautiful, but also there isn't a whole lot of life outside of the marine mammals. In contrast, you drop down this hole into the freezing ocean, and in front of you is an amazing amount, a surprising amount of benthic diversity and color. So there's a representation of a lot of the common species you might find here in the kelp forest or in the tide pools. For example, there's species of sea stars, anemones, and sea urchins, and there's also a bunch of unique species. So all the fish down there have adapted an antifreeze protein in their blood so that their blood doesn't freeze in the sub-zero waters down there. There's also some species that are usually small in different parts of the world, But in the cold waters of Antarctica, they grow to be a lot larger than you might expect. There's sea spiders that look like daddy long legs about the size of your hand. There's isopods, which are usually small, roly-poly looking things that grow to be about maybe 4 inches long down there as well. So there's a lot of really quirky, really interesting life, as well as some things that look surprisingly like what you might find here.
Did you ever encounter the psychedelic sounds of the Weddell seal during your Antarctica trips, as we see in the Herzog movie?
A lone Weddell seal slips through the frigid water of the ice-strewn bay.
Weddell seals are the most abundant seal down there, and they make really remarkable sounds underwater. And you can hear them underwater when you're diving, and it's really incredible. It's really hard to tell what direction they're coming from. It's almost like it's all around you. And then you'll see some seal floating way above you. And you can also hear from above ice if you put your ear down to the ground sometimes as well. And again, it's hard to tell which direction it's coming from, but you hear it reverberating from the water underneath.
Okay, we are live with Umi at KCSB 91.9 FM.
And now we're back with Sisters of the Blue on 91.9 KCSB FM.
Hey Umi, what are pteropods?
Pteropod in Latin means winged foot, little snails. And these snails, instead of having a regular foot like any normal snail, has evolved its foot into two big wings. And so their foot has turned into two wings, and they use that to swim around in the water. So they're pelagic snails, snails that swim in the open ocean, instead of being stuck on the bottom somewhere. And they're considered plankton. They can swim up and down, but they can't exactly fight against a current. So they're sort of in big swarms in the ocean and go where the currents can take them. And in the Southern Ocean, they're a big part food web, especially where we are in McMurdo. They're a big part of the fish food, so a big part of fish diets are composed of pteropods there. And of course, that means that the pteropods are indirectly feeding all of the penguins and the seals and everything above these small fish in the food chain as well. And so they're a very big part of the zooplankton and a very important point in the Antarctic food web. These pteropods also make shells like a snail, and so they have these shells made out of a particularly dissolvable form of calcium called aragonite. And we're concerned about these aragonite shells and how they might potentially be dissolving under future and current pH conditions.
So where did you go to collect these guys?
We were really interested in collecting pteropods at different places that we could get to. And one of the places we decided would be really interesting was this place called the Ice Edge. And that's where, like I said, we're usually traveling on frozen ocean, but at some point the frozen ocean ends and then it's just regular ocean in front of you. And so you can drive out near McMurdo to the spot called the Ice Edge, where you drive out on solid ground on ice. But of course, there's thousands of feet of ocean under you. And then you can sort of walk up to the spot where the ice ends. And it's usually a very just stark line where as you get closer and closer to it, you want to be careful and be making sure that the ice is solid and thick all the way through as you approach the edge. Because sometimes there can be some cracking and some unsafe things around there. It's also called the lunch counter because that's where leopard seals and orcas will sometimes come to feed on penguins. And so because of that, we're always particularly careful while we're working out there, and of course only work out there with the permission of the National Science Foundation. We've been very lucky to have mountaineers come out with us and help us rig up safety harnesses so that whoever's working closest to the edge is also on a safety harness. So So it's been very helpful working with these people, us collect pteropods out there.
That is so cool. And I want to interject with a question that's more near and dear to my heart. I spent about 2 months in Antarctica from December, January, and February back in 2013. And there was this amazing ice cream machine there, which, believe it or not, has a name, Frosty Boy. So, Umi, can you update us on how Frosty Boy is doing these days?
It finally broke so badly that they decided to get rid of it.
Are you kidding me?
The flavors in Frosty Boy are part of, you know, everyone's asking what the flavor of the day is in Frosty Boy. The problem with Frosty Boy is it's a really old machine and they don't make many parts for it anymore and you have to get them shipped from the US. So Frosty Boy can break for a really long time. And so what happens is you're sitting there eating and you're like, is Frosty Boy working today? And so someone starts walking up to Frosty Boy and then like half the time he pulls the lever and nothing comes out. He turns around sad and like everyone's watching him. But you're waiting for that one guy to go try so you don't have to go be the first guy to figure out it's broken. But it finally broke so badly that they decided to get rid of it. And my friend walked in on the funeral for Frosty Boy with like candles and people were telling stories about their best time. I think a lot of us scientists, we work really weird hours sometimes in the Antarctic, especially if we have an experiment. We might not get to the normal meal times. And so it's really hard for us to get food sometimes if the dining hall sort of shut down. So they started making a 24-hour pizza, hot pizza tray, and they also started making 24-hour cookies. And they also now have a big fridge chest as you walk in the galley on the left there. Mm-hmm. So you get a plate, and on the left wall there, they actually now have like a bunch of fridges for to go, and they package up all the leftovers so you can take them into. Actually, the best is they started making breakfast burritos and wrapping them in tinfoil. So I heard that what people started doing is they'd go out and do their work, and they'd keep their truck idling, and they'd put their burrito on their engine block to heat it up. And so they'd heat their tinfoil breakfast burrito on their on their car engine. And we realized what we could do is when you're diving, so in that nice warm hut above your dive hole, there's a space heater in the corner. Mm-hmm. So I put my burrito on the space heater and have someone turn it halfway down when I'm halfway done with my dive. And when I come up out of my dive, I can have a nice warm toasty burrito. One thing tricky about Antarctica is, especially if you're working outside, you're burning a lot more calories than you usually are. And so you are, even just being outside, you're burning a lot more calories. And so to make up for that, they serve a lot of really greasy, unhealthy food, which means that you think, you know, you're going to be out in a harsh environment, you might lose weight, but you really don't usually. Then they make extra greasy food. And I think, I don't know about this, I want to look it up again, but apparently your body starts conserving your fat stores and trying to burn protein instead when you're in cold conditions.
Oh.
Which means that they supplement as much protein as they can into their foods, which means they start adding milk powder to a lot of it. And apparently this is something they do, dietitians recommend if you're vegetarian and you need more protein. I've asked my dietitian friend this, and apparently it's pretty common for vegetarians who need more protein. They'll start putting milk powder in everything. So my lactose intolerant lab mate had a really hard time.
Wow, the idea of a breakfast burrito in Antarctica right before work is truly sublime. We're going to take a break right now and listen to We Are Divide by The Shins. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
7 days a month you made the mile to my house. And how we do. We struggle with you. Far below. Time can do.
And now we're back with Sisters of the Blue on 91.9 KCSB FM. Have you and your lab mates come up with any creative ways through art and science to represent your research in Antarctica?
So I think that one thing that's really tricky in science is communicating what you're doing to a broader audience. And that's partially because, you know, sometimes we do things in faraway locations and it's hard to bring people to those locations, you know, and sort of to bring the experience to them. And it might also be because scientists, you know, we aren't exactly the most personable people all the time. And, you know, it's, we think as scientists, and it can be really difficult sometimes to find new ways to engage the public. So I think one really good thing that people have been thinking about more and more is how to present science through art and music. Scientists can have a very set way of looking at things, but adding an artist or musician or somebody who thinks outside of those lines into the mix and to have them help you present things and sort of have new ways of bringing these experiences to the public can be incredibly valuable. So the National Science Foundation has really recognized this, and they have a long-standing program called the Antarctic Artists and Writers Program, where every year they fund a few artists, musicians, poets, writers to go down to the Antarctic and help present our science to the public. And one example of this is our friend Henry Kaiser, who's a scientific diver, but also a musician, and has released albums of Antarctic music, soundtrack movies about the Antarctic, and overall has really helped to try to bring the Antarctic to the public in a more abstract way.
And we're actually going to play Henry Kaiser's piece right now, and it's called Under the Sea Ice, Part 5.
And that concludes today's show. And tune in
next week on Sisters of the Blue, KCSB 91.9 FM.